Growing up when one of your parents is behind bars. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. It happens more often than you might think. The number of children in this country who have had or currently do have a parent who's incarcerated. What does that do to a child's psyche? We're going to hear from one young man who's had that experience and a group here in South Florida reaching out to those kids to mentor them. Also, Florida is going to be impacted by climate change, perhaps more than most other states.
As of today, every piece of pavement in this state is paid for by gas tax.
Yet our leaders are battling with local governments to halt solutions to the growing climate crisis. We'll hear the latest episode of WLRN's podcast, Tallahassee Takeover. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Hope you had a wonderful new year. Great to be back for 2022. I want to start the show off today with a number that blew my mind. There are close to 6 million children in the U.S. who have or have had a parent behind bars. That's about one out of every 12. That's according to the latest figures from the nonprofit The Sentencing Project back in 2018. Well, one organization based in South Florida is trying to help those kids right here. Silent Victims of Crime is a local nonprofit that provides mentoring and resources to kids whose parents are imprisoned. Paulette Pfeiffer, who goes by the name Tinkerbell, is the nonprofit's founder and executive director, and she joins us now. Paulette, or I should say Tinkerbell, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hernandez. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. Also, I want to bring in Xavier. He's been through the program with Silent Victims of Crime in the other state that they're in operation, which is South Carolina. Xavier, welcome to the program. I appreciate having you.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
You know, Xavier, I wanted to start with you, you know, being one of these kids. And as I said, this number really, I never read that before and it blew me away. But tell me a little bit about having a parent behind bars. How did that affect you growing up as a kid?
Well, having a parent behind bars really took a toll on my life in ways that I did not know or acknowledge at the time until I got to a certain age. A certain age is where I feel like things kind of came up more for me to know. Because I think my mom kept this from me with my dad being incarcerated. So it was something I didn't know or understand at the time until I got to a certain age. As I would say, maybe 13, 14, something around there.
So
I knew my dad then, but didn't really understand it till then.
So wait. So your mom tried to keep this from you?
Yes.
And when did she tell you? How did she tell you?
Well, I found out from hearing a conversation with her, talking to a friend, and she tells her friend, well, Zay's dad just got out of jail, and that's how I find out. And I'm like, my dad, and all this time I thought my stepdad, which was her husband at the time, and still is to this day, I thought he was my real dad, but come to find out, he wasn't.
So here, you find out you had a biological father, which was not your stepfather. It was that you had a biological father, and then at the same time, you're finding out that he was imprisoned. So you've got a lot that you've got to try to, you know, make sense of, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot. That's what I'm saying. Like, at the age, I could not make sense of it. I didn't know. So it took a little more years after that to actually truly understand what it was. But at the time, no. I was really shocked. I remember calling Tinkerbell and was like, you know, Charlie's not my dad, Tinkerbell. And, like, she was even mind blown because she didn't know.
Actually, Zay had not been actually in our program. His sister was in our program at the time. Mm-hmm. And Zay called me up hysterical because we involved him in everything we did and said, Tinkerbell, Charlie is not my dad. Charlie is not my dad. My dad is in prison or just got out of prison. And I don't want to speak to them. And I ran over there and picked them up and we went for a ride and talk about it. And so it was a shock to him to find out at age 7. That he had a different dad. So it took many years to process all that he knew as to be different.
So I mean, look, I can't I can't put myself in your shoes, Xavier. I can't even begin to imagine what that's like. What did you know, like, after you find out, what did you know about him? About what did you learn about him? What did you learn about his crime?
Well, after some time passed, you know, my mom just, I believe I had some conversations with her. My dad was dealt with drug addiction and, you know, shoplifting a lot. So that was the main two things I did know, like hear about him after the fact of finding out.
Yeah. Tinkerbell, I mean, you hear these stories. This isn't new for you. You hear these stories and I'm wondering, like, what's the biggest challenge for a child? And I don't know, is that usually when they find out around that age?
No, they usually, in most cases, find out that their dad is in prison pretty early on. Some of them, the parent is trying to maybe safeguard the child. They think that they're protecting them. And that's what happened with Zay's mom. Zay's mom is a really good lady who worked very hard to be a good mom to him. And Charlie is an amazing guy who still adores Zay, and Zay adores him. They were trying to protect them, thinking that he'd never find out that he had a dad in prison. But the truth is, children should be told when they're old enough, certainly not at age 7, maybe when they're 10 or 11 or 12. And I think that that's what they were waiting for, to not have to have him go through at such a young age. But once we found out, there was nothing that was going to stop him from meeting his dad.
And by the
way, so that was the next step.
You know, I'm just wondering, do you tend to find, is it fathers who tend to be in prison, or do you see a good, like, a mix of, maybe it's the mom sometimes who's imprisoned?
There is a very large number of women in prison in some of the states, like South Carolina, especially where he was growing up, although he lived in Florida for the last few years. Zay has been here. So I was thrilled to death to have him here in the state. But in South Carolina, there are several large women's prisons. One of them is Leith Corrections, where it's all moms, so 800 women. And in Chicago, we worked with only women as well. And then we ended up working with male facilities. But there are more males arrested than females. But there's been a 200% increase of females in the last 20 years.
Wow.
That go to prison, 200%. So we have now, of course, still a large disparity between men and women. But when the mom goes away, it is 10 times more hurtful.
So Tinkerbell, you know, do you recommend that the child be in touch with the parent, stay in touch with the parent? You know, because look, in this situation, Xavier finds out he has a biological father who was in prison. But let's say in other cases, the child knows the parent is in prison. What do you recommend they do to keep that relationship strong? Stay in touch? Do they tend to do that?
It is very difficult to convince a parent who is the legal guardian who's raising the child, because it's not always the parent. In most cases, it's a grandparent, an aunt, an uncle, and often the mom and dad are in prison at the same time. And so for the child to be raised by a caregiver, the caregiver should be told that once the child knows that they have a parent in prison, that they should be encouraged to see them if they want to. So if the child wants to see the parent, often the caregiver does not want them to go there, even if it's their own son.
Yeah.
Very often. So we do encourage them to let the child go, because no matter who the child is, no matter who the parent is, no matter what the parent has done in our lives, the child always wants to see and know their parent.
Mm. Again, I'm talking with Paulette Pfeiffer. She goes by the name Tinkerbell. She's the founder and executive director of Silent Victims of Crime. And we're also speaking with a young man in South Carolina who's gone through this program, Xavier Roebuck. Xavier, as I mentioned, you're in South Carolina. That's where the organization also operates. It's Florida and South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get connected? Tinkerbell said your sister was already going through the program first, right?
Yes, my oldest sister was already going through the program with her mother being in prison.
So how did this organization help you? I mean, you spent time with Tinkerbell. She's talking to you, helping you deal with this reality. But what else did the organization do that really helped you?
The other thing that the organization did to help me was, I mean, it opened my eyes to a lot of different things. It helped me see life situations differently. And it also gave me courage to want to work with kids and actually be a service to kids and a future for myself. And I think that's a huge impact alone, because I feel like I can do great things and will do great things when I put myself to it. And that's just a blessing right there alone.
Mm. You know,
well, a big part of our program, Mr. Hernandez, is that the children are in therapy whenever needed, and that the children have a summer camp with us so that they're growing up with children who they've known all their lives and growing up as an extended family. So Zay had a very strong support system. We mm-hmm. work in South Carolina with Clemson University with the Call Me Misters, who were their mentors and literally helped me raise these kids, because these are all young men who are going to be teachers in schools throughout South Carolina. And we have a similar program in Florida. We work with UM and FIU to find mentors for the children who are male African-American role models.
And Tinkerbell, yeah. The kids also meet each other?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes. We're in groups. Oh,
okay. So, Xavier, what was that like?
I actually still have strong connections and strong relationships with some of the kids that I grew up with in this camp when it was We Stand for Kids. To this day, I still talk to them and still, you know, stay in contact with some of them.
Well, no, that's fantastic. Tinkerbell, I got to ask you, first of all, because I wanted to ask about how you started this program, but I got to ask you, where did the name Tinkerbell come from?
Everybody thinks that I was named by the children, but I'm 4 foot 10 and a half. I used to be 4 foot 11 and a half. So, you know, I was never very large. And when the kids are 10 years old, they immediately want to stand next to me to say, I'm taller than you, Tinkerbell. But the name Tinkerbell started when I had a group of kids in Chicago, and we were in Printer's Row in Chicago. There's a church, multidimensional church, and the minister just got off the podium and a rabbi got on the podium. And the minute he started speaking, the lights went out. And the rabbi said, where's Tinkerbell when we need her? And pointed right at me and said, our Tinkerbell is shining right in front of us, and made me come up to the podium and light the candles.
That,
and I think the experience was so incredible, because, you know, lighting me up suddenly as Tinkerbell, that the name just stuck. And that was 26 years ago.
Wow.
And our program is 24 years old.
This program, tell me where the idea came from. For you, how did it launch?
Well, the idea of children of prisoners wasn't even an idea or a concept when I started looking for children of prisoners. I worked with the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Drug Enforcement Agency in the Eastern District of New York. And I was working with the parents who were being arrested, and they were being extradited from other countries. And I would say, where are your children? Like the thought of them leaving the children or having been deported from their country and leave the children behind was beyond me. And they would say, I don't know. And I went, oh my God, this most heartbreaking experience I can see is that separating parents from their children, no matter what the reasons. And I started looking in American prisons, what happens in the state prisons when a parent goes to prison, like what happens? So I started interviewing prisoners. And the prisoners would say, I don't know where my children are, custody was taken away, or maybe somebody's raising them, or maybe they were adopted. And I started getting interested in what happens to their children or prisoners, and learned 27 years ago that children of prisoners are this lost group of kids that nobody knows what happens, because when an arrest is made, whether it's FBI, CIA, DEA, it doesn't matter who walks into a home, into a bank, into a gas station, they're there to arrest that person, that adult, that grown up. And when they make the arrest, they never ask, do you have any children and are they safe? So the children are left in parks, they're left at school, they're left on the streets walking, they're left in a room with a drug dealer who they don't even know about. And so they're being raised by whoever gets them, if they get the luck to even be raised by someone or end up on the street. Miami-Dade schools has Miami-Dade County has 15,000 children whose parents are in prison. There are 8,000 children in Miami-Dade who are homeless. We started making the connection of the homeless and the children of prisoners.
Because
they're the last group of children in the United States.
Yeah, and you know, because that got me thinking is like, you know, what's the most common challenge or issue for kids in this position? Is it homelessness?
I want you to know you hit that on the head. That's one of them. But certainly our biggest competitors are homelessness, the drug dealer on the corner, or the gangs. Wow. So if we can fight those, then we win. In the last 15 years, our children have not gone to prison. The program is 24 years old. And the first few years, we had a couple of kids that ended up in prison because we did not know that if you don't work with the entire family, that you will lose them.
Yeah.
Because the parent comes home from prison, two of my mothers killed themselves. And they had no place to go, what to do.
And again, I go back to the statistic that I threw out at the beginning that almost one in 12 children in the country have had or has a parent that's incarcerated. And, you know, again, that I think really is very telling. And I just wanted to, again, remind everyone what we're talking about here. Again, what happens to these kids? You know, what kind of options do they have? And we're talking about a nonprofit group here in South Florida that also works in South Carolina that's trying to give these kids a second chance, a better chance. The group is called Silent Victims of Crime. We're talking with Paulette Pfeiffer, the founder and executive director. You hear me calling her Tinkerbell. She goes by that name. We're also talking to Xavier Roebuck, who lives in South Carolina, who's gone through the program. Tinkerbell, how do you monitor these kids, keep tabs on them after they've left to make sure? Because as you said, that's a great statistic that, you know, none of them are ending up in prison, that they're moving forward with their lives.
Well, that's not to say that I'm in touch with all 800 children that have gone through our program. I'm in touch with about 240 children. And very often you can't get rid of them like Zay. They want to be in touch. They want to be in
touch. She's
not
leaving me. She's never leaving me.
So they usually call my husband Grandpa Neil. And so they get used to being raised around us. As a matter of fact, the first group of children, Mr. Hernandez, were 12 of them. Zay was not one of them. 12 children who spent their weekends in our home. My husband and I taught them how to cook, how to swim, how to ride a boat, how to go. Zay, you ended up at the end coming to our events, to our weekends. I know you remember some of them. Do you remember learning about life from our, what would we call them, our daily tours that we went out collecting branches and flowers and whatever?
More like scavenger hunts at the lake.
Scavenger hunt at the lake.
So you really connected with the kids to let them know, listen, you're not alone.
I think that's a big part of it, is that we create this extended family that is not just me and my husband and our volunteers. It's the community. We get the community involved. Like in Florida, UM and FIU have given us our interns for the last 10 years that we're here. In South Carolina, it's been Clemson University. And not only do the interns interact with the children, and the children think of them as part of their families, there's some family members that they don't treat as well as they treat us.
Right.
I go to graduations where grandma is put in the extended room, you know, in the override room, and I get to be there in the main room, or one of our amazing volunteers that has mentored the children over the years.
You know,
we have over 200 volunteers that work with the kids.
Xavier, I got to ask, I mean, here you were, you find out. And again, you had a mom and dad, your stepdad, but so you find out that you have a biological father, and again, he was in prison. What was it like growing up at that point? And you have Tinkerbell in your life. You know, what was the rest of your childhood like?
The rest of my childhood was very good. As far as I can remember, my childhood was very good. Like, I was in a home with my mom and my stepdad, and it was an amazing home, full of love, full of great things. It was never bad. It's just I learned and found out that I had a biological dad that was just never there. Once I did find out he was there, he would try to come around, but that goes back to, like I'm saying, his addiction to shoplifting that kept him in and out of prison. So when I did get a chance to see him, he would take it away until it just finally clicked with him to just finally, you know,
did you ever
say for himself, enough is enough.
Did you ever, you never reconnected with him then?
I reconnected with, well, let me say this, because I reconnected with my father as of 2020, because I moved to Delray Beach area myself to go to rehab. And that right there sparked me and my father's relationship. And it has been better since then. And we talk almost every week now.
And so, you know, what's that relationship like now, having those conversations? Like, what, you know, how are you helping each other?
I think we're helping each other by just actually trying to be there. Hmm. And sometimes I have to admit, sometimes I fall short in doing my part in trying to reach out. And he steps up and kind of gets on my case about it, because at this point I'm grown and he's grown. So it's a two-way situation here. We both got to meet each other at this point.
I think I can fill in a little bit, Mr. Hernandez, because I know a little bit more of some of the things behind the scenes. When Zay first met his dad, it was totally a shock for both of them, but they've recognized each other. I didn't tell either one of them that I was bringing the child there, but I spoke to the manager that knew that I was bringing his son. From the day they met, there was a connection. Now, I want you to get this really, really straight. We will never take a child to visit a parent that abused them, neglected them, or abandoned them. So we follow the same rules as social services. But if a parent was a good parent, just wasn't around because he's in prison, we don't feel there's a good enough reason to separate the children from them.
So
it was good for Zay to meet Dad.
Yeah, but you know, Tinkerbell, how common is it for the kids not to want to communicate or see that parent?
Almost never. Almost never. Because the child wants to see the parent. It's the parent that's not able to do the communication. But once the parent has the child back in their lives and the children are back in the parents' lives, it's a very positive interaction most of the time. If we see any negative interaction going on more than one or twice of the visits, because we take children to visit their parents in prison, we immediately stop it until that can be fixed, either by therapy or by speaking individually to the parent and the child so they can be back together again. But I know that one of the most important days in Zay's life was when he graduated high school. I mean, we were all there, the entire asylum victim. We go there for all the graduations. And Zay's graduation was a major because he was with us since he was two years old. And when he graduated college, I managed to get his father out of prison to be there. And the look in his face, in his eyes, I have tons of pictures of that day. And Zay, do you have memories of that day?
Yeah, I have memories I'll never forget of that day.
I know. It was
one of the most important days that I would have never thought he would have been there. But he was.
You know, Xavier, I'm wondering, for you at this stage of your life, the challenges you're dealing with, what's pushing you, you know, forward? You know, what's inspiring you, motivating you, you know, to follow your own path?
Well, first and foremost, God is keeping me on a narrow path to what I want in life. And it's just being surrounded by love, knowing Tinkerbell. I have connections in good places right now. And it's just staying positive, keeping positive vibes around me. And to one day to work with kids and do the same for kids for what was done for me, that keeps pushing me.
Is it true that you would open up a food truck?
Yes. I would love to have a wing truck.
What kind?
Like, I don't know. I'm really good at cooking like wings. Like,
okay.
I really love chicken wings. And I just want to one day eventually have my own wing truck, different types of wings. Like, you'll be shocked.
Well,
to my food truck.
Let me know when that opens up. I love myself a good food truck, so definitely. Xavier, I really appreciate you spending the time sharing such a powerful story with us and everything that you've been through. And Tinkerbell, thank you so much for sharing with us. And if people needed to, you know, find more information, if maybe this is something that they could use to help them, I mean, do you find the kids or somehow they find you?
Actually, that's a great question. Sometimes the police calls me. In South Carolina, it was very frequent that the police would call me about a kid just roaming the streets. In Florida, it's more common for the school to call me because they know all about me. We've been speaking for 24 years on this issue of children of prisoners. And the school here are very familiar with what we do. And the teachers and the social workers all know our number because I do seminars every year to the entire school system. And so they call me here. But often it's the police saying that they see a kid wandering around, or with the school saying our kid is homeless. I wonder if his parent is in prison and we find them.
Yeah.
But very often it's once we go to prison, the other prisoners then want to know what our program is about.
Right.
And therefore it's a by recommendation, as interesting as that sounds.
What an amazing, cause that you have going right now. And again, I just go back to those numbers. Still hard to believe so many kids going through this, but thankfully someone like you is out there. Again, I've been talking with Tinkerbell, her real name, Paulette Pfeiffer. She's the founder and executive director of Silent Victims of Crime. We'll share some information about them on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Also want to thank a young man, Xavier Roebuck, from South Carolina, who went through the program sharing his story. Xavier, Tinkerbell, thank you so much for sharing with us today. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Thank
Just
you.
Keep remembering, 72% of children or prisoners go to prison.
Well,
ours don't.
Let's hope we can change that for the better. Well, still to come, what happens when local governments want to take steps to be more energy friendly, but state leaders say no? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. This past summer, Miami joined cities across the state by pledging to lower its greenhouse gas emissions. The idea is to try to stave off the worst impacts of climate change, which could swamp Florida's coast with a few feet of sea rise by mid-century. But Miami's plan, like others across the state, was weakened by a set of new state laws. Those new laws block municipalities from regulating fossil fuels in their own communities. The laws are part of a wave of gas industry-supported bills that are sweeping the nation, all in response to efforts from cities to cut down on their emissions. So far, 19 states have passed similar legislation, with another 5 states considering the bills this year. That's all explained in great detail in the latest episode of the WLRN podcast, Tallahassee Takeover, and we wanted to play it in full for you now. Here's part one.
With Florida on the front lines of sea level rise and the impacts of climate change, a lot of local governments are stepping up and trying to reduce carbon emissions on their own. But what happens when the state government has other ideas?
We could pave the roads with gold, but somebody's going to complain about the glare.
Every year, lawmakers in Florida meet in Tallahassee to propose and pass new laws, present a budget, and represent their communities in the state capital. And in recent years, that agenda has included a targeted focus, keeping towns and cities from making too many of their own rules, rules that could end up influencing policy around the state. This is Tallahassee Takeover from WLRN News. I'm Danny Rivero. High tides getting higher and higher, record temperatures in the summertime, and rising groundwater levels that contribute to flooding for regular old rainstorms. South Florida is one of the areas most at risk for the impacts of sea level rise and climate change. And so a lot of local governments are coming up with their own plans to fight climate change, to do their part in a global effort to reduce carbon emissions. But when one city made a bold plan to cut fossil fuel emissions, it led to a huge backlash from Tallahassee that puts a lot of these efforts in jeopardy. Alex Harris is a climate change reporter for WLRN partner, the Miami Herald, and she's going to be joining us to talk about this. So, Alex, help lay the groundwork here for what local governments are doing with their net carbon zero plans that have been coming out. Like, what are they pushing for, and how do they imagine that they're going to meet these goals?
So there's no statewide plan in Florida to convince anyone to reduce their carbon emissions. So local governments have sort of taken it upon themselves to do this. They've got a lot of different ideas for how they want to install solar panel on public buildings. They want to convince more people to use public transportation. They want to convert their fleets of buses and cop cars to electric vehicles. But they all kind of have the same goal, which is to get to net zero carbon emissions by 2050. And a lot of them have midterm goals. So, for instance, the city of Miami has a goal to reduce 60% of its emissions by 2035.
So because there's no statewide renewable energy plan, cities have been taking it upon themselves to reduce carbon emissions, because if they don't do it, at this point, it looks like it's not going to get done.
Right. Yeah. There's no state plan. There's not even a hint of it from this administration. But at this point, cities can do what they can. They've got control over their own employees, their own buildings, their own cars. And so they're using every tool in their toolbox to make a difference.
Earlier this year, there was a forum in Miami where a consultant working with the city laid out potential plans for blocking natural gas connections to new constructions as one way to potentially limit greenhouse gases and to help meet the city's climate change goals. So we're about to hear from Josh Lathan. He's with the consulting group AECOM, and he was working with the city of Miami to develop its climate change plan.
So to achieve 60% reductions by 2035, the city would need to get to 100% renewable electricity, construct 100% electric buildings, so that is excluding or prohibiting natural gas hookups in residential and non-residential buildings. The city would need to retrofit 40% of the existing buildings' natural gas systems, so space heating, water heating, things like that, and convert those to electric options.
So what you hear there is how cities are actually thinking about meaningful plans to slash their emissions and get to net zero. So they are talking about more than just installing more solar, about having more buses, committing to more electric cars. They're talking about natural gas hookups as part of that strategy. Now, it's only one part of the equation, because natural gas only makes up about 5% of total emissions in Miami as of 2018. But it's one of the few areas where the city actually has a lot of control. They can put new policies in place. They can change the way new buildings are built. This is something that they actually can play a role in. And when you talk about getting to net zero by 2050, zero means nothing. So you have to hit everything.
And this is the one area where a city can actually control it, because they can't necessarily control what Florida Power and Light and other utility companies do on the energy generation side of things, right?
Exactly. You can't tell FPL, we'd only like solar power, thank you. But a city has a lot of control over new construction and building codes. They can tell a new home or office building they have to be really energy efficient, or that they don't want them to have a hookup for using natural gas.
And just to back up for a second, what exactly is natural gas and how does it factor into how cities operate here in the state of Florida?
So natural gas is actually a fossil fuel gas. It's a combination of a bunch of different stuff, mainly methane, which is about 28 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide is. It's most commonly used in Florida to generate power. About 70% of our energy comes from burning that gas. But people also use it in their homes. In most of the northern part of the country and also northern parts of Florida, natural gas is used for heating up homes and businesses. But down here in South Florida, we see a lot less of it, and mostly it's used for heating up water or using a gas stove.
And a resolution came out of the city of Tampa in January that changed everything with this. City Council member Joe Citro shared a resolution that he wanted to bring forward that would have banned natural gas hookups for new constructions, but it also called for banning new fossil fuel infrastructure from being built in the city. And that included things like pipelines, compressor stations, and many people feared that that language also included gas stations. Citro said the plan was written in anticipation of an uptick of electric cars, and people are just going to start driving more electric cars, so they needed to prepare for that in the future. And I recently talked with Citro about that proposal, and he said within hours of releasing it to the public, a bill was already filed in Tallahassee that would completely undercut it.
It was almost spontaneous that some of the fossil fuel industry could take offense at wanting to save our city a few dollars and keep our energy clean and protect our environment.
Citro told me that when his resolution was made public, it caused some serious panic in cities across the whole state. And what he was hearing from people is that they feared it was going to make Tallahassee so angry that it could lead to a huge backlash that would leave local governments less able to reach those net zero emissions goals that they had been laying out the plans to do. And Citro said he agreed not to name the specific cities or officials that he was hearing from, but that the fear they were telling him about was very real.
I had people from all over the state calling me and saying, you know, Councilman Citro, please withdraw this resolution. You're going to jeopardize what we already have in place. And that's how strong the resolution was going to be. That would be retroactive to all these other communities that had already put something in place to for clean energy. Our former mayor, Dick Grocco, said it best. We could pave the roads with gold, but somebody's going to complain about the glare. This resolution was the best for our city, both financially and environmentally, but somebody's going to find some fault with it, no matter what, in anything that you do.
Again, Citro's proposal would have banned new fossil fuel infrastructure from being built in the city of Tampa and banned natural gas hookups for new homes and businesses. And that really shook state lawmakers in Tallahassee so much that they fired back with their own proposal.
Their answer to Citro's resolution undercut much of what he was hoping to achieve in Tampa. It blocked cities from banning the use of fossil fuels, and that includes natural gas and new construction. It was effectively a ban on bans. Let's listen to Republican State Senator Travis Hudson talking about it in a committee meeting. He represents St. John's and Flagler counties and part of Volusia County.
We're just prohibiting the elimination of current energy sources, and that's the plan. So any new projects we're trying to do, any pilots that would do clean energy, you're certainly allowed to do that. You just can't completely wipe out the old energy that's already on the grid. I don't know whether we're going to be fully off gas fuel at 2030. I don't know if that's a realistic idea to get to in 8 or 9 years, but maybe it's realistic in 15. So I think we need to just look at what those ordinances are. But again, there's nothing that prohibits them from doing new energy. It's just the energy that's already on the books trying to eliminate that. And that's what I'm most concerned about.
And then fellow Republican Senator Ed Hooper joined in.
Well, don't go anywhere. We're going to hear part two of the latest episode of Tallahassee Takeover and the state's response to the changes that local governments are trying to implement. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. We're in the middle of playing for you the latest episode of WLRN's podcast about preemption. It's called Tallahassee Takeover. This particular episode is exploring what happens when local governments want to cut down on their fossil fuels, but state lawmakers and industry officials work to stop it. Here's part two of the episode. When we left off, WLRN reporter and host Annie Rivero was introducing Republican State Senator Ed Hooper.
He represents parts of the Tampa Bay area and Pasco and Pinellas County, and we're about to hear him respond to parts of the conversation that look to things going on in California as what Republican members of the Florida legislature are really trying to prevent from happening here in Florida. And it was in this part of the conversation where it becomes very explicit that this bill Florida state lawmakers were taking up in Tallahassee was in direct response to that proposal that came out of Tampa.
I know you spoke of a city or cities in California that have started a conversation about banning gas stations and whatever else they choose to ban. A city in the Tampa Bay area had that discussion, and it went far enough to scare some of us that a fairly large city in the Tampa Bay area that starts with the word Tampa had that discussion with their elected officials, and it was a serious discussion. Now, I don't have any objection, and I know there are communities in my district that have adopted 100% clean energy into their comp plan or whatever they want to talk about. That's admirable. I think someday that will be achievable.
But State Senator Hooper also zeroed in on why limiting the availability of gas stations in particular would actually, in his opinion, create a massive problem for the state.
As of today, every piece of pavement in this state is paid for by gas tax or diesel fuel tax. And those that think electric cars are the greatest thing, and they will be someday, they don't pay a dime to pave our roads or build our infrastructure in this state. So if the goal is to eliminate gas stations or gasoline importation into our ports or any of those fossil fuels, somebody's going to have to pay the freight someday to keep our infrastructure in a condition that we can move around safely and appropriately.
But that fuel tax, it actually doesn't apply to natural gas that's used in residential and commercial buildings. But it does speak to the general sort of anxiety around pushing residents too quickly into renewable energy, especially when you think about cars. So after a lot of back and forth, the bills did pass on a party line vote with Democrats voting against them. It bumped through a couple more committees where it narrowed a little bit, but the end result was pretty much exactly what they wanted from the beginning. Local governments could not do anything to prohibit a certain type of energy. They can't ban natural gas hookups, they can't block gas stations from being built, and they can't even require gas stations to include electric vehicle chargers. And the lobbyists in favor of this bill were the usual suspects, exactly who would imagine. The Florida Petroleum Association, the Florida Natural Gas Association, and the Florida Retail Federation, the Florida Home Builders Association, and the National Utility Contractors Association of Florida. Not many of them spoke at these meetings, but they all signed up in support of it.
So we know the Tampa proposal was the spark that started this conversation in Florida, and we know the lobbyists that lined up to support the bill once it was on the table. But do we have a sense of where this legislation came from in the first place?
Yeah, so the concept of creating a natural gas ban isn't unique to Florida. These bills have been passed in 19 states, bans on natural gas bans, and at least five other states have introduced that bill in their current session this year. An investigation by The Guardian earlier this year showed that the American Gas Association was actively coordinating and lobbying for the passage of these bills. And here in Florida, our reporting at the Miami Herald found that our versions of these bills were actually written by lawyers for the utility companies, and they follow model legislation advanced by the American Natural Gas Association.
So in the end, despite a campaign from environmentalists and cities saying they didn't want this legislation, a pair of bills passed here in Florida, which pretty much do the same thing, which is banning local governments from banning any specific types of energy. Basically, fossil fuels.
And after all of that drama, the city of Tampa decided to return to what it started. City Councilman Joe Citro, who we met earlier, actually brought back a new proposal that took those laws into account with some tweaks. And this time, he actually got it passed, even though it wasn't exactly what he planned in the first place. And Citro told us that as bad as the bills seemed to him, in the end, they didn't stop him from doing a lot of what he was hoping to get done.
There was just certain verbiage changes. We tried to eliminate the words fossil fuel as much as possible. Other than that, there really wasn't all that much of a change. When the players came to the table, sat down, talked to them, made them understand that this wasn't going to put them out of business, I think it became a little bit more acceptable to those people and those corporations.
The final resolution, which passed in August, committed the city to 100% renewable, clean energy by 2035. But some significant parts of the original plan were cut back, like the city's ability to cut natural gas lines to new home constructions and blocking new pipelines from being built in the city.
Are our hands tied? No. Wallets may be a little constricted, but I feel that we are going to be able to take major steps at getting it done with the consumers, with the businesses, and with the administration.
Either way, Tampa became the 12th city in Florida to commit to 100% renewable energy by 2035.
We've heard a lot of sustainability staffers say, hey, I'm interested in still exploring this. Is this still something that I can consider? And our answer to that is yes, absolutely.
Emily Gorman is the Florida director of the Sierra Club. And Gorman told us that despite these big, scary bills in Tallahassee, a lot of local governments are still moving toward their clean energy goals, which is a good thing.
The way Gorman looks at these new laws is that they don't stop cities from moving towards clean energy, but the cities just have to be more creative about cutting carbon emissions because state law now takes away that all-or-nothing approach that some of the cities were actually flirting with.
And the way that we talk about this now with activists and advocates is that it limited your ability to prevent, to ban, or to prohibit. It did not take away your ability to incentivize or encourage or to plan, right? So we would call this taking away your sticks and leaving your carrots, right? You no longer have the sticks, you have the carrots.
And Gorman says the Sierra Club is actually learning that bans on certain kind of energy, like natural gas, are too much of a blunt force in the real world that we live in. And in that sense, Gorman says the bills actually encourage more cooperation between the utilities and local governments, so that in the long run, it might actually be better for the movement towards renewable energy.
The chilling effect comes more from the word on the street than it does the actual language of the bill, right? There's a rumor going around, you know? And so when I talk to local officials about specifically this preemption, what we most get is relief. Oh, I didn't realize I could still do so much. The transition to 100% clean and renewable energy is a market shift, right? This is a structural change to the way that our economy operates. And so with that in mind, as we make more choices for renewable energy, it gets easier and easier to do more. The more you do, the more you can do, in a sense. So really, we shouldn't be in a position where we need to turn to bans.
But in practice, what we're seeing in the city of Miami doesn't completely line up with that theory. If you remember earlier, we were talking about Miami's plan to ban natural gas hookups in new construction and convert a portion of natural gas-powered buildings to electricity. A few days before the Tallahassee law passed banning natural gas bans, Miami announced a bold new plan to cut down on carbon emissions in the city. It had lofty goals. It talked about solar panels. It talked about public transportation. But on the exact same day, the city commission gave first approval to a 30-year franchise agreement with TECO, a major natural gas company. And that was on Earth Day, April 22nd.
So on Earth Day, the city said it wanted to severely cut emissions, and at the same time, it signed a new contract with the natural gas company?
Yep.
And the city knew that these bills that would ban natural gas bans were on the horizon in Tallahassee. At that time, did that fact affect the city's plans in any way?
The city knew those bills were going to get passed. Everybody knew those bills were going to get passed. And Miami knew that if they did, it would significantly weaken the policies that they were hoping to put in place to cut on carbon emissions. But my reporting also found that at the same time those bills were moving through Tallahassee, the city was actually getting a lot of pressure from that same natural gas company, TECO, to roll back its clean energy goals. So the cities were really getting it from both sides here, a lot of pressure to roll back on all of their carbon emissions plans. On Earth Day, before the bills in Tallahassee passed, Miami had a goal of getting 100% of its new construction to have net zero emissions by 2035. So they weren't releasing extra carbon emissions into the atmosphere and causing more global warming. But when the final plan was released in mid-November, when those bills were already law, that goal was reduced to only 5% of new construction. From 100% reduction down to 5. And a big part of that was these laws getting passed in Tallahassee. By the state kneecapping these efforts to get to 100% renewable energy for new buildings, it makes it actually impossible for any city to get to 100% renewable energy. In order to get there, the law would have to be changed some point in the future. Because as it is right now, every single new home built in Florida will still have the option to connect to natural gas. And so some people are always going to take that option.
And while the state is blocking cities from some of these tools that can get them to 100% renewable energy, Florida still doesn't have a statewide clean energy plan, which is actually in stark contrast to the other most populated states in the country. Like, for example, both California and Texas get about 25% of their energy from clean energy sources. But Florida is the third most populous state, and we get about 3.2% of our energy from renewables. So compared to the other two biggest states in the country, we're actually falling way behind.
That's right. And if Florida doesn't pick up the pace, that's going to make it harder for the entire nation to get on track for the national clean energy goals, which makes it harder for the world to get on track. And if we don't hit those goals, we're locking ourselves in for a future of increased heat, extreme weather, and more flooding. And Florida is squarely in the crosshairs of what scientists say is coming if we keep the business-as-usual attitude. activists and local politicians are calling on the state government to show leadership on this, to issue a clean energy plan and actually move toward a more green energy future in the Sunshine State. And there are bills filed in Tallahassee every year that would move the state towards this goal, but they haven't gone anywhere. In the meantime, the only thing the state government seems to be doing is limiting what cities can do when it comes to renewable energy, instead of actually taking the lead on this issue.
Alex Harris is the climate change reporter for WLRN partner, the Miami Herald. Alex, many thanks for coming on to talk with us about this.
Anytime.
Tallahassee Takeover is a production of WLRN News. This episode was reported and produced by Miami Herald reporter Alex Harris, with me, Danny Rivero. It's edited by Lance Dixon and Alicia Zuckerman. Our engineer is Merritt Jacob. I'm Danny Rivero. See you next time.
And that's Sundial for this Monday, January 3rd. I wanted to thank, we had production help today from Elliot Rodriguez on the program. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk with an epidemiologist to answer your Omicron questions. So if you have any, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Post them there or email us sundial@wlrnnews.org. Also, we're going to talk about books tomorrow with book expert Connie Ogle from the Miami Herald and Mitch Kaplan from Books and Books. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.